Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
About that brief interruption, the gremlins that host Expanding Mind are still with us. Technology, as always, is a bit of a trickster. Anyway, so there I was in this forest in the middle of nowhere, and hearing these three guys pulling out the most sort of aggressive, crazed, distorted, exuberant, mad kind of music that in some sense sounded nothing like nature. It sounded like technology gone completely awry, and yet somehow it made total sense that in the midst of this somewhat bucolic setting, there was this ferocious noise, this black metal extremity. And the band in question was Wolves in the Throne Room, one of my favorite American black metal bands, although even calling them black metal is a bit of a misnomer, because while they use the form, they move in deeper directions, have their own concerns, musical and otherwise. And today we'll be talking to the drummer in the band, Aaron Weaver. They've just gotten off of a tour supporting their new record. But before we bring them on, of course, we're going to introduce our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. So these guys are from the Northwest. You're from the Northwest, aren't you?
I am. In fact, I went to college at the Evergreen State College, which is in Olympia, Washington. And it was there in this tiny little room. I didn't see Wolves in the Throne Room there, because that was this was like in the 90s. But I did see one of my favorite metal bands, which is, I don't think I can say their name on the air, but it was the FN Champs, and they're like real mathy metal, you know, really melodic, and people usually affiliate Olympia with kind of hipster music and, you know, Bikini Kill and the Riot Girls and all that kind of thing, but there was actually quite a few serious metal dudes. I think because there is so much forest up in Olympia that, you know, it's funny you said you saw these guys in the forest. I think forests and metal kind of go together hand in hand.
Yeah, so can you tell me one thing about the nature in the Northwest that has stayed with you, even though now you are in the, you know, urban blight of Los Angeles?
Oh, man, so much. I mean, it's just so green. You know, you go and the greenness just goes into you, and it's that damp green kind of mystery, foggy, rainy darkness that just really gets into your bones.
Yeah, and that's definitely an inspiring inspiring sound. So, well, with that in mind, let's bring on our guest, Aaron Weaver. How's it going, Aaron?
I'm good, Eric, and I'm good, Maja. How are you guys doing?
Very good.
Yeah, I'm stoked to be on the show. I'm a fan of the show, and I'm definitely glad to be here. I'm a bit sick, so my voice might be a bit scratchy, but I think I'll be able to muddle through.
Well, hopefully you have some liquid there to, you know, cool off the vocal cords.
I do. I've got some slippery elm tea with a variety of other strange herbs into it, so yeah, I'll
excellent.
Be okay.
Excellent. Sounds perfect. Well, I remember when we spoke after that gig, I was kind of sort of impressed that you definitely did not sort of fit whatever stereotype I might have had about somebody who would wind up playing black metal, both in terms of your musical background and your own kind of personal life story. And you know, I'd really love to start out with that, to talk a little bit about, you know, where you came from when you were, you know, working in D.C. and then how you kind of music you were playing and interested in, and then how you found your way into this you know, very interesting, very powerful genre.
Yeah, totally. The band is myself and my brother Nathan. And there's been people that have come and gone over the years, but we've definitely been the core of the group, both musically and aesthetically and as far as just sort of setting the boundaries of what the band is going to be and what it's going to be about. And we both grew up in Olympia, actually. I was born in Topeka, Kansas, but Nathan was born in Portland, so he's very much a Cascadian child. And we've lived here ever since we were little kids. The house we live in now is about, I don't know, a quarter mile away from Evergreen State College, and it's about half a mile away from the house that we grew up in. So we're really connected to Olympia and the surrounding environment, both culturally, and I think also, you know, really tied into the landscape as well. You know, the forest that we live in now is the very same forest that we played in as kids. And it's been really, really amazing to watch it develop over the years. It's kind of been this force that's always watched over us. And, you know, the nature in the Northwest is something that's always been really, you know, crucial to our development. But also, you know, like Maja noted, Olympia is really well known for having a pretty vibrant, you know, music scene. You know, she mentioned Bikini Kill, and, you know, there's 20, 30 other pretty well-known bands that you could name that come from Olympia. And there's record labels like Kill Rock Stars and K. And that's definitely the scene that Nathan and I came up in when we were kids. Like, you know, in middle school, and then, of course, in high school, you know, we were definitely going to shows at the Capitol Theater downtown, which I'm sure is a venue that Maj is familiar with.
So many shows that I saw
totally.
There.
So we were probably, you might be of a slightly older generation. I'm 34.
Oh, I'm 36. That's crazy. We might have been at the same shows.
I totally imagine that we were.
Oh, that's nuts.
Yeah, yeah. It's a small world, man. And it's interesting how people, you know, the paths that we all end up on, you know.
I know.
Yeah, it's wild. So anyway, you know, we came up in that DIY scene, but we were always metalheads, you know, and I think that we're always more interested in the woods than we were in, you know, the kind of more urban the kind of stuff that you're into when you're into living in the city, you know, hanging out at the bar and kind of the more hipster side of things. But we were definitely, you know, punk rockers. You know, we had like a, you know, very political view of things.
Well, that's the thing that's always struck me about the Northwest. Maybe you can talk about this a little, because I had the same effect, is it does have this urban scene. Like, you can go to Seattle or Olympia, and there's all these very much kind of genre hipster type of people because of the music. But then you can travel, like, literally 15 minutes and be in the middle of a rainforest, you know?
Absolutely,
so
yeah,
while there
yeah.
are these very urban environments, it's like, you know, you're literally right next to a jungle. So I know for me and all my friends, even as teenagers, I grew up on an island, on Vashon Island. And
oh,
so,
you live in Vashon? Okay.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah. I mean, we would all go to the woods. And like you said, the woods had such a deep effect on us. And I was hugely into metal even when I was in, like, seventh grade. I remember the first Metallica song I heard, and that was it. What do you think, like, being in the woods has to do with that metal thing? Because there is, like, some kind of thing about metal and the woods that is really deeply connected. How do you kind of put those two together?
Yeah, well, you know, I've always thought that metal, and especially black metal, and especially where black metal has gone in the past 10 years in the United States, is really the flip side of the hippie scene.
Mm.
You know, it's really a mirror image. You know, it's music that's very much about magic, and it's very much about spirituality. It's very much about myth, and in that sense, it's not you know, it doesn't have this hipster pretension of being of trying to be cool. You know, metal is not cool. You know, metal doesn't like put on these hipster fronts and try to have this sort of you know, this cool facade. You know, it's really, really raw, and you're not afraid to get in there and really expose the kind of deepest parts of yourself. And I think that, you know, really the connection to the woods is, you know, there's just a lot of spiritual power in the woods. You know, cities certainly have their own sort of magic and energy to them, but the woods have, you know, they've got something that's, you know, to me feels very, very ancient, something that feels eternal, something that feels, you know, very inhuman, something that's beyond humanity and human culture. And, you know, those are a lot of the themes that run through metal and animate metal. So, you know, any time that you're in a majestic place, whether in the mountains or the rivers, the forest, you know, I think metal is the music that, you know, always makes sense to me. You know, that's the music that I hear when I'm in these sort of special places in nature.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about, because I think on first listen, or, you know, if someone's, you know, hearing this and doesn't really listen to metal or never made that connection, it doesn't really make sense, because it sounds more like this very sort of, you know, it's not urban, then at least, you know, deeply technological sound, because there's so much distortion and so fast and so kind of inhuman. And yet in that inhumanity, it sort of opens up into a kind of cosmic direction, and you see this kind of in terms of the evolution of the music. But I'm curious, just when you guys started to play, or when you know before the band and the other kind of music you were doing, or the other kind of bands you were in, was that like a sort of slow evolution, or do you feel like you are already, the kinds of things that are motivating you now were sort of part of the plan from the get-go?
Well, I think that, you know, the things that we're into now in our lives and in Wolves in the Throne Room have always sort of been there. But definitely, I think we moved away from it for a long time. You know, I think when we were kids, we very much lived in a very magical world. Because, you know, we grew up in the woods, and Nathan went to a Waldorf school. And so, you know, we had this sort of hippie, gnome-oriented, crystalline childhood. And then when we got into punk music in our, you know, teens and maybe into our early 20s, I think we really moved away from that. You know, I think we were looking at things in terms of, you know, a very materialistic point of view, like in terms of looking at the world as political systems, or thinking about economics. And, you know, we were pissed off. We were, you know, wanting to change things. We were definitely disaffected, but we were thinking about it in terms of, you know, what can we change in the economy? What can we change in terms of the political structure? You know, we were like political punk kids. And, you know, and I think it was about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that I moved to Washington, D.C., and Nathan stayed in Olympia. And, you know, it was this kind of, you know, the standard post-college drifting period where we were feeling a bit listless, and, you know, things didn't feel very meaningful, and we were definitely searching for, you know, the next step. And it was my idea to move to the East Coast and, you know, just get kind of a straight job, you know, somewhere in the lefty publishing world, or, you know, working at Harper's, or, you know, that sort of scene. You know, I had a lot of friends who had moved out of Olympia and had gotten those sort of jobs in New York or D.C. or somewhere like that. And I kind of always assumed that's what I would do, too. And while I was out there, I kind of had a bit of a breakdown. You know, once I was in the belly of the beast, and I was away from the woods, I realized that, man, it's just not my path at all. And so I moved back to Olympia, and Nathan and I and some friends pooled our resources, and we bought an old farm on the outskirts of Olympia, and decided that we were going to go down a completely different direction, that we were basically going to become, you know, we're going to become the kind of hippies that we always kind of laughed at when we were younger. You know, we're going to build our own shacks and learn organic farming and really transform our minds and our consciousness, and, you know, move it away from, you know, this idea of understanding the world as this big mechanism, and try to get in touch with, you know, the spiritual side of things, or the mystical or the mythic side of things.
Well, and the way you guys are living, I think, is such an important message to people, too, because, I mean, traditionally, in America, people will affiliate black metal with Satanism, you know, and certainly, I mean, there's people that have suffered as a result of that. You listen to metal music and everyone thinks you're suddenly a Satanist, when really, I mean, it's more paganism and that kind of nature worship and thing like that. And certainly there are metal bands that are satanic. There's your good share of black metal bands that are openly satanic in their visions. But the real, like, for me, that opening in metal is the paganistic thing, and your guys' lyrics are so reflective of that. So to see the way you guys live your life, I think, is so important, because that shows not only are you interested in the philosophy or the ideas or even the sound, but you guys are actually living your lives according to those ideas and philosophies.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the goal. The idea is to, you know, not just have Wolves in the Throne Room be this artistic outlet, or have it just be, you know, a hobby or something we do on the side, but have the music and the spirit of the music be completely interwoven into a greater vision for things. And so, you know, to that end, the music and the development of our farm and, you know, trying to live a lifestyle that's pretty fucking far, pretty far outside of the mainstream. You know, it's one project to us, you know, developing as spiritual people and developing as, you know, tradesmen and farmers and developing as, you know, musicians is one project. You know, that's something about the modern world that has always really bothered me, is this intense need to compartmentalize things, to have your work self and your home at family self, and the self that goes out with the boys on the weekends, and the self that might have some sort of, you know, hidden, embarrassing, artistic outlet, the spiritual self that goes to church, the self you have with your parents. You know, that's something that I try to, like, to dissolve as much as possible in my own life.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, I want to play a track from the new record in just a second, but first I wanted to ask you one question, is that, you know, how things, you know, obviously, you know, you're totally in it, of how things work in the sort of music world, where, you know, there's so many blogs, there's so many outlets, there's so many people who are writing about this stuff, and since you guys sort of cross over outside of a sort of deep metal scene, you know, there's even more people who are kind of paying attention to you and for whom you're maybe a little bit of a novelty, like, you know, some place like Pitchfork, the reviews sort of mostly, you know, indie rock, and yet you're sort of an interesting figure there, you know, you have all tomorrow's parties you played at, so people will interview you, and I did the same thing, you know, a couple of years ago. I was like, wow, these guys are actually kind of like walking the talk in a certain way. But at the same time, then you must realize, as you do these interviews and you develop a kind of persona, and the people associate, oh, Wolves in the Metal in the Throne Room, they're the guys who live out in the woods and, you know, communalists, and they're hip, you know, and then you become kind of not a cartoon, but you kind of carry this sort of image of your life that then gets fed back to you in interviews, and I can only imagine that's a somewhat strange process.
Oh, absolutely, man. Yeah, no, there's like, you know, most, but then again, that's a part of rock and roll. You know, mythologizing is such a huge part of music. And it's not just metal music that you have that sort of thing. I mean, think about Led Zeppelin. Like, a big part of that band is the mythology. Like, you know, they recorded the record in Crowley's house, and Jimmy Page is a 14-year-old sex slave, and they're performing these occult rituals. You know, that's such an important part of music, and that's something that, you know, maybe in the beginning I was pretty uncomfortable with. You know, people would come up to us after a show and be like, hey, man, what's it like living in that cabin, you know, just all by yourself out in the middle of the woods? And they obviously have this sort of extreme romanticized picture of what's going on. But I've kind of made my peace with it. You know, I've definitely done my best to try to clarify things and say that, you know, the fantastic romantic images that people might have obviously aren't entirely accurate, but you know, that's just part of the game, and I realize that that's you know, part of the enjoyment of music, the magic of music is letting yourself get lost in this world of pure imagination that the music conjures.
Absolutely, and part of that imagination carries over into what we think and imagine about the people making the music. Well, since we've been talking about your music, I want to play a little an excerpt from an 11.5-minute song, which we will not play all of, but from the new record. And I picked out this sort of section of it because it moves from a very slow, beautiful, luscious, folkish kind of music into the heavier sounds that we, you know, more associate with black metal, and so it could give kind of a taste of the range of the kinds of music you're working with, because you're definitely exploding the genre in a lot of ways. And this is the track Thuja Magus Imperium. What does that mean? What is Thuja?
Thuja is a cedar tree, or it's a Latin name for the cedar tree, which
Excellent.
Is, of course, you know, one of the dominant genuses around here in the woods.
Absolutely. So that's a beautiful title. All right, so we'll play this track and then come back and talk about it.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
All righty. Ferocious indeed. So you know, let's just talk about that a little bit. I mean, especially the move you've been making in your more recent records towards going into these slower, more pretty places, which a lot of, you know, old school black metal bands would, you know, vomit at. how did that progression go?
Well, you know, actually, I don't know if that's true, man. Like, I think that if you listen to that old school black metal, there's always been that space for that ambient sort of sound, or this mysterious, quiet, introspective sort of sound. And I think that when you listen to that old school black metal, which, you know, on the surface is very, very, very harsh and unrelenting and brutal, and it sounds, you know, on first listen, like your soul being ripped apart, when you really get into it, you realize that it is ambient music. It is this sort of gentle wash that is, you know, created with these harsh vocals and these brutal guitars and these, you know, blasting drums. But the effect, the goal of it, and I think that, you know, people that are really into the music are hip to this, that the goal of that wash is to create this ambience, to create this soundscape that you can lose yourself in. And to, you know, it's really, you know, trance music or music that's geared towards meditation and inward gazing.
I was just going to say it gets really trancey. I mean, and I wanted to ask you too, like, as a drummer, I mean, for me personally, I always see drummers as sort of aliens, and like, especially metal drummers, because I don't understand how you guys can play a show for like 2 hours and play the drums like that. I mean, do you, in making this kind of music and that kind of ambient wash, do you feel like you go into a trance as you're doing it?
Oh yeah, I mean not always. I mean, like with any sort of performance, you know, there's going to be some shows where you're just going through the motions, like you're tired or have a cold or hungover or have had a long drive in the van, and you're just you know, trying to get through the show and do the best you can. But there are other times when absolutely it's a moment of peak experience, and it has a transcendental quality to it. And I think that that's common to, you know, all music to a certain degree, but black metal, you know, that's specifically the goal. You know, the quintessential beat, drum beat in black metal is the blast beat, and you heard that a little bit in that song. You know, it's this very repetitive, very stripped down, very primal, pounding drum beat, like a very fast drum beat. And I've always thought that drum beat is really an analog to shamanic drumming on one hand, to the, you know, the four on the floor beat of techno music. You know, I think it's coming from that same, you know, very deep human desire to shift your consciousness with, you know, repetitive rhythm.
Well, you know, in a way that shift happens in precisely the process you were describing, in that, you know, when you hear these rapid beats, at first the reaction is to, you know, you know, it's like a, you know, it's like hyper fast dance music. It's like intense, pulverizing. But then you follow it, open up into it, and it can become sort of weirdly peaceful. It almost becomes like a blur. But that, so it's like musically there's a shift, almost the way that when you're, if you're going into trance, like if you're in a dance, you know, you're following the beat, you're in the beat, okay, I'm in my body, I'm in the beat, and then something kind of shifts. And then you're in like a different place. You're still in the music. You're still responding to it, but something different happens. And I think that shift into the ambience that's in this ferocious music is almost like modeling that kind of move into a more peaceful, trancey place, even in the midst of fury and anguish and intensity.
Yeah, definitely. And really, I mean, the way that I look at it is that it's opening up to a geography. You know, when you break through that wall, and you, you know, and are perceiving the music in this different way, maybe in this deeper way or this meditative kind of way, that's when you enter the world, you know. When we're making this music, when we're playing live and we're making records, we're very consciously trying to create an imaginative geography. You know, it definitely is a space that has its own sort of rules and its own dimensionality and its own mythos, its own reality. And we're trying to, you know, create a portal for the listener to enter that world through the music. And you know, and that what that world is the world we experience here in the woods. You know, that's it's the occult reality or the spiritual reality of the forests and the mountains of the Northwest, and the energies that we feel there and the things we've experienced. You know, we're trying to create a portal to that world with the music. You know, that's very much our intention that we always have in mind when we're playing or we're recording.
Wonderful stuff. Well, we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back. This is Eric Davis. We're on Expanding Mind, talking to Aaron of Wolves in the Throne Room, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're talking to Aaron Weaver from the eminent band Wolves in the Throne Room. And we're talking a little bit about metal. Aaron, this might be a personal question, but just as you were mentioning some of the shamanic drum kind of stuff, I was curious. I know you guys do live your lives with kind of magical intention stuff in your music, and I was wondering if you guys actually do like ritual stuff, like kind of pagan rituals, or observe any of those kind of things in some of the explorations of your investigation into these kind of ideas.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that Nathan and I both consider ourselves to be, hippie pagans, really. When it comes down to it, you know, I don't think we would affiliate ourselves with, you know, Wicca or anything like that. But I definitely feel connected to what you might call the neo-pagan tradition, you know, the hippie orthodox, religion that has emerged in the past 30 or 40 years. We don't do any ritual work on stage. And that's something that I've always been really, really opposed to.
Is there a reason for that? Why you're opposed to it?
Because, I don't know, I've got this sort of idea with music that I don't want to try to convince anyone of anything, and I don't want to influence people's perception of what we're doing.
Mm.
I just want to present the music on stage or present a record to people, and they can get into it, and they can get out of it whatever they want or need to. I just want it to be a mirror for them or a space where they can go inside themselves. I don't want to use our public performance as, some sort of energy vampire situation.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm very conscious of how I do kind of spells and ritual. And, I mean, I think there is that manipulation thing involved. And certainly, you know, people that might watch, like, Kenneth Anger's movies have kind of seen how some of that stuff might, you know, go down. But do you think there's a way to do ritual through music and performance that is not manipulative and not trying to, like, sway people's consciousness, but rather unify with other people?
I think so. I mean, and that's, I guess, so what we try to do, especially recording this last record. That was something that we were very, very conscious of and talked about all the time.
Right.
Because we were able to record the record for the most part at a studio that we built at our compound in Olympia. So we were in, like, a really... a consecrated space. And every day we'd make sure that we were not just making a rock record, but that we were opening a door, or
right,
we were, staying true to the intentions that we had for making the record. And, there definitely is a goal behind it. I guess we do want to influence people. But it's not a matter of wanting to
coerce right,
or, you know, use other people's energy to achieve something for ourselves.
Right.
Really, when it comes down to it, I mean, I hate to say it, but we basically have, you know, a bit of a new age sort of agenda. We're very much, you know, hoping for some sort of transformation in human consciousness that's going to move us away from this modern, materialistic, kind of shallow and banal world, or at least the aspects of the modern world that feel that way, towards something that feels deeper and richer and more open to otherworldly energies and, you know, another reality, a more spiritual reality. And I think to that end, we've got a lot of things in common with, you know, a lot of fringe cultures, whether it's burners or hippies or whomever, you know.
Mm.
Well, it's interesting how that the faith in that, or the trust in that process of transforming people through music, in this sense, it's almost a little bit more about the ability for people to listen to it in their own selves, you know, deep in listening to it alone, you know, very in a very deep, kind of profoundly personal space, rather than, you know, drawing them into sort of a movement through the, you know, collecting the energy of the live show. I mean, you saw that in the 70s, you know, incredibly powerful experiences, sure, you know, whatever, Led Zeppelin or whatever, where there's this sense of power being raised and sort of, you know, drawn up into the stage, and there's this kind of collective energy, and that's obviously really powerful. It's part of what ritual does with that kind of collective intensity. But one of the things that always struck me about metal and listening to it, you know, over many, many years, is that I got it more the more I was listening to it in a deeply isolated space. And it didn't mean that it made me feel isolated, because in some ways it actually allowed me to access emotions that and intuitions that were often kind of hard to get at when I was in the midst of society, and, you know, even with people that I had a lot to share, you know, share with emotionally or spiritually. But it was when I was on my own or in a place where I needed really to withdraw that I found that it actually kind of would glow the most. And
oh, yeah.
It's a funny balance.
Yeah, metal, to me, reveals the interior universe. You know, Led Zeppelin is, you know, very solar, if you ask me. You know, it's very much, you know, it's got this, you know, it's very much about a band on stage and everyone focusing their energy towards that band. But metal, you know, is something that hides in the shadows. You know, it's something that's very moonlit. It's something that, you know, thrives on mystery and ambiguity and paradox, and is very, very personal. You know, it's the kind of thing that you know, even though you might have that sort of cathartic experience at a metal show, you know, where I really get into metal is with headphones, you know, by myself, using it as a portal to look inside myself. That's the aspect of metal that I'm really, really into, is that opportunity for you know, self-reflection.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask a kind of a more of a muso question. I'm kind of curious how you see how America and American black metal bands have changed, or whether you can even generalize, maybe you can't, but it seems to me that there are some commonalities in the sense of, like, taking this music that's so associated with another, you know, geographical region on the planet, with another landscape, another kind of forest. And while there's similarities, like with the forest in the Northwest, there's a sense also that it's a different landscape. So it should, if this is partly pagan music, partly music of nature, it would change in this new environment. And I'm just kind of curious how you see yourselves in that, or how you see the difference in American black metal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, so if you look at European black metal, especially the black metal that has this pagan or heathen orientation to it, rather than a satanic orientation, you know, it's very much trying to conjure this, you know, lost, forgotten, you know, probably mythologized world of the ancestors. You know, it's trying to conjure up the warriors of Beowulf's Hall. It's trying to get in touch with, you know, the very specific gods of the Norse pantheon. You know, American bands don't have that energy to them. We don't have access to those same sort of energies, I don't think, because, you know, we're on a different continent. We are in a landscape where we are very much newcomers and don't have this deep connection to the land and don't have a culture that's connected to the land. And I think that maybe that's the quintessential defining feature of American black metal, and especially of Wolves in the Throne Room, is that we are very much Americans and we're very much disconnected from any sort of culture, any sort of tradition, any sort of deep connection to the land. And I mean, maybe that's the source of the despair and the sadness and the melancholy that you hear in the music, is because, you know, we're desperately seeking that sort of connection. You know, we desperately want to have some pantheon of ancient gods that we can turn to. We want to have some sort of heroic epic that's been passed down from generation to generation. And we just don't have that. You know, white people have been in the Northwest for, 100 years, 150 years? And in the meantime, we've destroyed it. We've destroyed all the sacred places that existed before, you know, the loggers and the miners and the ships showed up.
Well, I think that's very true, and it's really fascinating because the thing a friend of mine and I do is we'll look at some of the themes that are common to more American bands tend to be dismemberment. And that idea, like you said, like kind of being ripped apart and separated from things. And if you kind of look at a lot of the lyrics in the more American tradition, it gets way more dismemberment-y than like connected through mythology. I mean, to me, my favorite metal stuff is always the mythologized, archetypal kind of storytelling narratives. And when you see that even in the American ones, it's almost like they're trying to mirror that. Some of them will even make reference to, you know, Celtic or Nordic gods, like
you said.
It always feels a little bit
forced.
And it has this like disparity, like you mentioned, because I think part of it is they're not living that, you know, they're kind of trying to usurp it because they know they think it's epic, but then there's this difference you can almost feel in the music, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, that's why we're playing black metal and we're not playing hippie jam music. It's because we're tormented by that. We're tormented by the fact that we feel disconnected from the landscape, and feel disconnected from a sense of history and tradition. And the history and tradition that we have as Americans is, you know, one that's deeply fraught, and has so much darkness to it, and I just don't want to have a part in it. You know, I don't feel any connection at all to America as a political entity or as a mythology.
What is your ethnic origin?
You know, European mutt, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I got an Irish grandparent, a German grandparent, an English one, and a French one. And I've always been really, really drawn to, you know, as a child, been really, really drawn to you know, the mythology of Northern Europe. And I definitely feel very drawn to the lifestyle that one lives in the north, you know, whether it's in Norway or whether it's in the Pacific Northwest. But at the same time, you know, we have this deep sense of rootlessness and disconnect that that I think that with the music, we're trying to heal that. We're trying to, you know, create a new culture of our own, or we're trying to connect connect to an emerging tradition, an emerging culture that I think really is coming forward in the Northwest, or, you know, on the fringes of modern mainstream society. You know, like you said in the intro to your show, the cultures of consciousness, you know, I think that there is a new culture emerging. And maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's just happening on the fringes, maybe it's just my imagination, but it certainly feels very real to me.
Well, it's still significant to really stand in that place of yearning rather than trying to resolve it through an overly mythological idea about some gods from some ancient world. I mean, that requires a different kind of commitment than where you see the problem, you see the absence of connection, you see the loss of spirituality, of enchantment, of traditional lore. And for some people, it's like, okay, then we just got to get back to traditional lore as fast as we can. And they overlook all of these contradictions and the ruptures and create a kind of, you know, fantasy. Sometimes it can be, you know, perfectly fine and even very, you know, useful for them. I mean, I know, you know, people who practice Celtic Wicca and they're very, you know, they do their research and they do their best at it and it seems fine for them. Not my flavor. But of course it can also become kind of creepy too, where you get into a certain racialist kind of, you know, kind of reactionary headspace that didn't make sense in some ways. You know, it's like, oh, I hate the modern world. I hate all this modernity and all these, you know, these confusions and this rootlessness that is modernity. So I'm going to, you know, create a world that is deeply committed to one perspective or one idea of my racial background or of this, the importance of this kind of lore. And of course there's a lot of you know, difficulties with that, but it's such a richer place to, on the one hand, acknowledge the draw, the need for that deeper sense of meaning, the sense of enchantment, that reconnection with nature, but at the same time acknowledging the rootlessness, how constructed we are as we try to make these things connected, and how we still remain rootless in it. And then it's a work in progress. I think that comes through.
Yeah, yeah. A big part of it for us is making peace with the sense that we don't have anything, and the only bits of culture we have are these, you know, scattered fragments and the things that we can construct ourselves. But maybe that's all that anyone's ever had, you know? all that we really have are the things that we, you know, stumble upon in life. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person that romanticizes past cultures or past times. You know, I'm sure it's a very, very different mindset that people had 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. But I'm sure the people were still tormented by the same demons that I'm tormented by. You know, I don't have this idea that, you know, if we could somehow wave a magic wand and Odin and Thor would rise back up out of the fjords to be our gods, that everything would be okay. You know, I think that, you know, that we reconcile ourselves to the fact that, you know, being a human being is a matter of being always caught in a space of ambiguity and paradox and existential angst. But I liked what you said about how, you know, when you try to tap into these ancient sort of gods, it can take on a sort of sinister edge. That's a huge issue that we deal with in black metal, which oftentimes has a very, very strong right-wing edge to it. You know, people can get really deeply involved in the idea of blood and soil, and identifying very strongly with their own race, their own set of traditions. You know, that's something that we've had to struggle with and kind of fight against over the years since we've been involved in this scene or involved in the genre.
Well, talk more about that. I mean, I'm very conflicted about it because I find myself, I love this music, I also do a lot of it, and I often find myself going, oh, gee, but what are their politics? Gosh, you know, how do we work this out? And it's not like a trivial thing in the sense, and not just because it's a important issue and it's a big deal and there's some creepy stuff there, but it's more that I can totally understand why, within the spirit of the music and the yearning and the angst and the desire for a kind of deeper connection to the cosmos and to nature, why people go down that route. And at the same time, I'm deeply convinced that it's the wrong route to go. So
yeah.
I'd love to hear more of how you guys have wrestled with that and thought about it.
Well, I think with all, you know, I've always thought that fascism and racism are just cop-outs. I think that they're failures of imagination or a failure to find a better solution. You know, I think that racism and xenophobia are all about placing the blame on someone else. It's all about placing the blame on some Jewish conspiracy or placing the blame on immigrants for watering down your culture and not taking responsibility to look inside yourself and, you know, create something new. Say, hey, this is just the world that we live in. We need to create something that is appropriate for this time and place, you know, for our epoch, and not try to look back to try to recreate, you know, this forgotten, lost, pagan world of our ancestors.
Well, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit, too, in terms of some of those human issues, the role of the animal in there. I mean, even your guys' name kind of harkens back to that. I mean, it's not like a lost pagan thing, but when you're in the woods, it's a very real thing. And to me, that's why I've always liked your guys' name, Wolves in the Throne Room, because it has that connotation that animals are present in a human environment. And that's something when you live close to nature that's always sort of an issue. And I wonder, to me, I always look at like animals as solutions to people's problems, like whether they're political or racial or stuff like that. I always like to look at how animals operate. And I wonder, was there like, I mean, have you guys had animalistic experiences that kind of feed some of your themes in that sense? I mean, even outside of the maybe political issues of humanity, but how did the animal themes kind of work themselves in?
Well, I think it has to do with, you know, finding the animal in the human being. You know, one of the, you know, there's, of course, a cultural ferment that our band comes out of. And a part of it is, you know, the Olympia underground DIY ethic. And another big part of it is the, you know, culture of tree sits and of Eugene, Oregon-based anarcho-primitivism, you know, anti-civ sort of crusty punks, rewilding, you know, this sort of culture that is, you know, pretty dominant in the underground in the Northwest. And a big part of that culture is the idea that, and I don't necessarily buy into this idea hook, line, and sinker, but the idea that as soon as humanity moved away from, you know, this primary life way of hunting and gathering, and started to settle down, started to, you know, grow food, started to live in cities, that was the, you know, where we were tossed out of the garden and lost this sort of, we made this you know, very profound break with our true path as human beings, which, you know, would be to have access to that wildness, have access to that feral spirit. And that's a big part of what black metal is. It's trying to reconnect to that feralness, trying to reconnect to that animalistic, wild nature that, you know, modernity does force you to conceal. You know, it's not appropriate to have those sort of wild, animalistic feelings when you're working a straight job and living a normal life in the city.
Yeah, and it's funny to kind of create that in the inside the individual in a weird way. Like to think back about that sense of listening to the music in isolation on some level with headphones by yourself in a mood of deep interiority. In some ways, that's the kind of from one perspective, that's sort of the extreme of, you know, the modern individual. You're a consumer, you have your own iPod, you have your own music, you listen to it in your, you know, in your headphones in your own space. And yet at the same time, there's something about that, the very intensity of that interiority that then recreates a possibility of wildness, or at least a sense of it, a stirring within, which, you know, may manifest in all sorts of ways. But it does have that collective question too. It's like about people, you know, deciding collectively to move back, because part of that idea or that dream of living another life is like living in society in a different way, living in a tribe, living in a close-knit family. And I think part of the romance of your band in terms of the stories around you is, you know, is also the sense of that collective dimension. And so how does that work out in terms of the way that, like, the band becomes a certain kind of tribe, but then you have the world that you're living in with your families and with your sort of local environments? How much do you feel yourself part of, you know, in some sense, a tribe?
You know, honestly, more and more, I do feel connected to a tribe or to a culture that, you know, has its own distinct set of rules and its own traditions and its own values that is, you know, pretty far outside the mainstream. And that's, you know, been our dream and our goal for years, and I finally feel it kind of coming to fruition. And it's just small things. You know, I remember I got married about a year ago, last summer, and we had a big, you know, pretty traditional pagan hippie blowout wedding. It was a pretty awesome time. And I remember looking around at all the people who were there, all my friends and peers who, you know, most of them came out of the same background that Nathan and I have come from. You know, maybe at one point were these sort of cynical, urban, materialistic punk rockers, but now, you know, are just in this really, really different place. You know, I remarked to myself how many of the people at my wedding had a, you know, really strong, magical, personal, spiritual, or magical practice, or how far away they'd moved from, you know, just being an urban, nihilistic punk rocker and had moved into, you know, something that I think is much more positive and something much, you know, like, really deeper, you know, something that has some roots to it, or at least the possibility of setting down some roots. What was another example? Oh, another example is, one of our housemates at the farm had a little baby about a year ago, and the mother had a blessing way, which is, you know, this kind of cheesy hippie tradition, and it's the kind of thing that maybe I might think is kind of silly or kind of goofy sometimes, but at the same time it was really, really cool, because the woman that facilitated it was this older witchy woman who was in her 60s, and she had a blessing way for her daughter in a teepee in the Okanagan on their pot growing plantation in the 70s. And then there's a 40-year-old woman there who had a blessing way for her daughter, and then going on down the generations, there was four generations of women who had this exact same ritual.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a pretty small tradition. That's a very new tradition. But still, at the same time, for the people taking part in it, it feels very, very meaningful. You know, it might have the same depth as some sort of imagined brutal initiation ritual from some hunter-gatherer tribe 10,000 years ago.
It's creating an ancestral culture, really.
Yeah, yeah. That's the dream, I suppose. And that's what we're trying to do in our small way is open up the door to that possibility.
You know, we only have got a couple of minutes left here, and for some reason this question has popped in my head. I wonder if you could tell me about one of your favorite places in the forest around you.
Let's see. I don't know if I want to reveal all my favorite spots.
Well, you don't tell me where it is. What do you like about it?
The most magical place I've been recently is a hot spring in the North Cascades. That's pretty near where they filmed Twin Peaks. I guess we haven't really talked about Twin Peaks yet, but that's something that features pretty prominently in our lives.
And totally.
Definitely Twin Peaks tapped into something that's very, very true about the Northwest and the weird stuff that happens out there. But there's a hot spring up in the pretty deep up in the North Cascades that is a truly amazing place. You know, for some reason it didn't get logged off. 100 years ago, some old prospector bought the land, and it never got contracted out to loggers, so the old-growth forest is still intact. And he was digging for quartz crystals in the side of this mountain. And he hit a spring of boiling hot water when he was about 30 feet deep into the side of this mountain. And so nowadays it's this very beautiful and amazing sanctuary that is a cave filled about chest deep with a very, very hot, very healing water, amongst this old-growth forest just a few paces away from a rushing river. That's one of my favorite spots I've been to recently. But
that's a marvelous vision as I look out at the blight of Houston, Texas.
It's Houston.
Most marvelous indeed. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for being on the show, and best of luck with everything. And we didn't even really do the proper pumping of the record.
That's for the best. I hate that kind of stuff.
Yeah, go out and buy Celestial Lineage. Five Wolves in the Throne Room.
You can download
there I did it. But thanks a lot, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. Goodbye, Maja.
Bye.
All right. From Maja and me, keep your minds open. Mm-hmm.